Accession number 11945, Rule 4.
Mr. Claxton, Rule 4. You were telling me that the picket boat would tow you in close to the shoreline. You'd row in the last few feet.
Yeah.
And then as soon as it was shallow enough, the troops would jump out of the whaler and wade ashore. How many soldiers could you get into the whaler?
Well, whaler? I should say about 15. Because then we had the galley, whaler, and there was a pinnace, what we call a pinnace. It was a big boat.
But you were in a whaler, weren't you?
Right? Yeah. That because all this included their equipment as well. You know.
Their equipment,
their packs and that.
How many journeys did you make from the ship to the shore and back?
Well, it depended. I did about three, I think. But it depended. You were back and forward, back and forward. And I think I did about three. I just forget, really. But I know they were on the go all day. They were on the go all day. Things are a bit blurred.
What do you remember what the shoreline looked like, what the beach looked like and the ground inland?
Rugged. A little bit of beach and the cliffs. That was their trouble, the cliffs getting up there. But as I say, they were protected when directly they got to the beach, they were protected because before that it had been very heavily bombarded with everything each ship had got. I mean, we were pushing in 12-inch shells there, as many as we got.
Did the shelling go on while they were landing?
No, not while they were landing.
It stopped before, did it?
Stopped before then. And also, for what, I don't know how true it is, but it was rumoured that the Queen Elizabeth was bombarding over the top and sort of blind, didn't know where things were. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, because rumours were rife. There's no question about that. I do remember that at the back end of the day, that particular day, they started bringing the wounded back for transferring to the hospital ship. I remember.
Were you getting a lot of fire coming from the shore towards you then?
No. As I say, all we had was that one casualty. And that was a bit of bad luck, really. We never lost one. As far as the crew was concerned, we never lost one man, bar that fleet surgeon. And he was on board.
What were the sea conditions like when you were rowing ashore?
Very good, very good. Normal, not rough, normal. Yes, we had it nice for that. But as I say, in the trouble that one thing followed another when the ships got there and we couldn't get through. That was the main object, to get through into Constantinople and through the Bosphorus to allow the Russians to get supplies through. Or get through supplies to them. When we couldn't do that, and we still stopped there, the Mudros and Lemnos, where they made the base for the army and that, wasn't all that far away, and there's plenty of natives around there. I mean, they knew everything that was happening. They knew that the troops were not there for a game of cards. And they prepared for it. The German general out there was a Lyman von Saunders. And he was no mug. He'd got everything prepared waiting for us. When the poor old troops got there, they never stood earthly.
Do you remember what regiment they were from, the troops you were ferrying ashore?
Middlesex, Royal Fusiliers, Middlesex Regiment. And also we had a proportion of the Anson Naval Brigade. Not many, but I think we had a total of about 800 aboard, all told.
Where did you pick them up? Where did they come aboard?
Previous night, they pegged down for the night on board.
But where did you collect them from? Did you go to Mudros to collect
them? No, they were brought. They were brought by troop ship from Mudros. We didn't collect them. They were brought to us.
And then they transferred
to us, you see.
How did they do that? How did they get them from
boats again? We had trawlers out there as well. And they were brought by trawler and that. They weren't brought by picket boat or anything like that. Brought by trawlers. And as I say, they pegged down for the night on board. They're fed and watered and that.
What impression did they make on you, these soldiers?
They were quite contented. That was my impression of them. They were quite contented. They didn't know what they were in for. They had no idea what was aboard ashore for. All they know, they were going ashore on a job. They didn't know what looked at them, really. I don't think anybody did. I don't know whether there was any, you know, midnight, nighttime scouting parties went ashore to reconnoitre. That I couldn't say. But I doubt it. I doubt it. As I say, once the ships got there and stopped there, it's like playing a game of cards, showing you cards before you play it. That's how I read it.
You said that, you know, you were in the boat some of the time. What were you doing the rest of the time?
Up on board with the gunnery officer again.
Carrying messages?
Yeah. I was, for that day, I was sort of surplus for requirement. He'd got all his work cut out with that. And with some of the naval officers, I remember one, Lieutenant Williams, he went ashore and stayed ashore for some while on a beach party, as a beach party. And some of the sailors stayed ashore as beach party. I don't know who it was, but they were coming back aboard, they were retailing stories and that. And one of the stories I heard was this Lieutenant Williams put that light out during the night. Apparently somebody come up with the light. But of course, one of the main problems there was feeding and watering them. But the conditions I'd lived under must have been terrific. Cold at night, hot in the day. Millions of flies about of a daytime.
You mentioned the wounded coming back on the ship. What sort of wounded were they? What had caused their wounds?
Well, they were mainly walking cases. I mean, those that seriously wounded were straight out to the hospital ships. They weren't. I think there was a couple of. Oh, there was one hospital ship. Whether it was more or not, I don't know. But the walking cases brought aboard, and then from there, if necessary, eventually sent to the hospital ship when they became available for them, as it were.
Did they say anything about what it was like ashore and what had been happening to them?
I don't recollect, really.
Do you remember if their wounds were mainly caused by a rifle fire or by shell fire?
Mainly by rifle fire. Because the type of the ground and that wasn't sort of suitable for heavy gunfire. Cliffs and rocks and gullies. In fact, there was nearly all rock, apparently, higher up. Yeah. I'd like to have gone out there again, but I never had the opportunity. Oh, well, I have been. After the war, we went up through the Dardanelles, through the Sea of Marmara, to Constantinople, and I served some time up in the Black Sea. That was during the Russian Revolution, when they were trying to overcome Georgia. I was on another ship then. I was on HMS Swallow. We were sent to Batum, Poti, Sebastopol, amongst other places. We was helping a General Denikin, a white Russian.
The Army of South Russia.
Oh, yeah, helping General Denikin. Also, one of the ships, HMS Albion, it was either the Albion or the Canopus, was sent to Archangel. Also to help overcome the communists, but Russia's a big place. Russia's a big place.
To get back to Gallipoli, you were there during the landings,
yeah,
putting the men ashore.
Yeah.
What did the Implacable do after the landings?
We didn't stay there long after that. We were then sent to Italy came into the war. Italy came into war. No, sorry. We were sent from there. We were sent to the Suez Canal to do a stint up there because the Turks, there was a possibility the Turks come in trying to get through to the Suez Canal to Egypt. So we were sent up there and anchored in the canal for a while. How this is so vivid in my memory is that we was ashore. I was then in between what I've first told you about Gallipoli and Suez Canal. I then transferred to the Wireless branch. And I can remember being ashore with the Wireless people.
You're doing training in...
Training in... We was making an aerial, because the Wireless in those days was one massive, huge, great aerials from mast to mast, like a huge wire sausage. And not all wires, but say a section there of about 6 foot wide, then another section further on, the wires passing in between about 6 wires in. But so huge, great things they were always making those. Because we was then only on, there was no such thing as valves or anything like that.
Where was the wireless school then?
You were trained on board. Your first thing, all you want to know first of all was the Morse code, to be able to send and receive. That you start. Once you could do that, you were classed as an operator. The technical side, you learnt at home. Yeah.
How long did it take you to get the Morse code to pick it up?
Well, it varies really. It depends on the individual. You can a fortnight, you can read it, say about 15 words a minute, and as you go on, of course, your speed goes up, and that, and also your transmission with the key goes up. But it's something like talking. I mean, I could run through the alphabet now, after all these years, as easy as it.
How did they go about teaching you, then? Did they leave you to study, or did they give you lots of practical exercises?
Well, you study, you learn to transmit on a key with a little buzzer. And the receiving, you learn from somebody else transmitting to you.
And you just sit and take it down, which was it went along.
Sit and take it down. Well, you get to a point, Some people get to a point in Morse, because Morse is obsolete now, they're never used. But then you'd got to such a point in Morse, reading Morse, that people could read it and type it at the same time. Yeah? Normally you'd write it. You'd write it down on a pad.
What sort of rate was the normal operational speed then?
About 25 to 30.
A minute.
Words per minute, yeah. I mean, you have to remember that the fella, apart from what the fella being able to read it, somebody's got to be able to send it, and they had got automatic transmission then. Yeah. And I found it very, very interesting. Very interesting. Going forward through the years, when I was on HMS Vindictive out in the China Seas, we had a chief petty officer telegraphist there named Bull, Johnny Bull. And he lived in Walthamstow. He designed and built a little shortwave set. It was a concoction. Instead of just turning it right on top of the set. You should have a handle about that long.
About 2 foot long.
Keep away from the electronic noises, what they call, I forget what they used to call it now. But you get that, you go there, and we picked up Whitehall from Shanghai. Out in the China Sea, we picked up Whitehall one night. Oh dear. Rushed around and found a yank, poor old Johnny Bull out of his hammock. Come on! And that was marvellous, really, because the wireless were all dead. It was huge, great bells then. So we went to the Suez Canal, we stopped up there, and then when Italy came into the war, we were sent to Taranto.
What did you think of Egypt? When you went ashore,
we were just stuck in a canal looking at sand. We didn't go ashore there. No, I went ashore on the sand, but not in the town, not in Ishmaelia.
So you didn't go into town at all. You didn't go into any towns?
No. Into the canal, and we stopped there till we were recalled to Taranto. I have been there to those places. Port Suez, Port Tufik, and Ishmaelia, and Port Said. I have been ashore in all those places. Subsequently, or on the other times I've been out that way.
What did you think of the climate out there? Because if you were there in the summer of 1915...
Egypt, warm, lovely. It's beautiful, beautiful.
You didn't find it too hot?
No, not really. No, because you have tropical clothing. You're not tropical clothing, which is shorts and helmet, or your helmet then, because the old straw hats had been done away with. I joined the Navy when it was straw hats. Part of the rig of the day.
Like a boater.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes, a straw hat. It was the rig of the day. And it was the First World War that they did away with them because it was a fire hazard. They were straw, you see. They never issued them anymore after the war. Yeah.
What were you doing while you were at Taranto then?
Taranto? Well, sort of moral booster for the fleet, the Italian fleet. But one of the things I didn't go on it, but one of the things we did was send a boat patrol out and stop out for a week in the Bay of Taranto, submarine hunting, and come in at the night time, submarine hunting, like a whaler, come in of the night to the shore, come in of the morning to the shore and stop ashore. On the beach for the day, and then out, sleep, and often go out. No, I don't know you should do that. Have a stint of that last about a week. And from Taranto, we got sent home. They brought us home. And I left the implacable.
Tell me about Taranto. You say to give a moral boost to the Italian fleet. Did you see much of the Italian navy?
Only as those that were there, based there.
What impression did you form of them?
Well, how do you mean, from an efficient angle? Oh, we could never tell. We never did. All the liaison was with the upper crust, as it were. I mean, us Oaks. We used to join in with them and that, but not on exercises.
Did they look clean, the Italian ships?
Yes, oh yes. Well, they were well kept, because this was before Mussolini's day. That was when King Emmanuel was on the throne.
And what did you make of Italy when you went ashore?
Well, let's say, Aelia, just like any other Mediterranean city or town. It was all wonderful to us kids. Wonderful. Good times, any kid. Oh dear, come home and tell your parents you've been out in the Mediterranean. Oh dear. I mean, now it's a weekend, a short weekend trip, isn't it?
Were you able to keep in touch with home?
Yes. Not every day, but you wrote a letter and you... Eventually they got to you. They arrived somewhere eventually.
Yeah. How long would it take, do you think, for a letter to get...
When it got actually going would be about a week or 10 days. China, we used to... that was after the war. We used to send them by Trans-Siberian Railway. That used to take 12 days. But by sea would take about 6 weeks.
When you went back to Chatham, were you happy to be going back home to England?
Oh, yes. Yes, always nice to come back home. Come back home, we were given leave, and from there I was sent up to, this is be about March time.
March 1916.
That's right, yes. I was sent to HMS Leader, LEDA, Fleet Minesweeper. She was an old crook, he was. But anyway, she was up Scapa Flow.
That's been a bit of a change for you.
Pardon?
A bit of a change for you to go from a ship like the...
Oh, yeah. Not only that, you got 6 pence a day extra for being on a small ship. What they call hard line money. That was inconvenient. When I say inconvenience, it was a rough life compared to a battleship.
Why was that? What was so rough about it?
Well, the living conditions. I mean, it's crap. I mean, a submarine in those days, he wouldn't. Nowadays, they're detailed to go there, but in all those days, they were all volunteers. And to get them into the submarine service, the inducement was 2 shillings a day extra. Well, you get an able seaman who only earns 1 and 8 pence a day, another 2 shillings on top of that. He's in clover, isn't he? If he comes alive out of it, with 2 shillings a day, hard line money. Destroyers and small ships, 6 pence a day, hard line money. That was anything under a couple hundred ton. Well, of course, the submarine now is about 3,000 tons and displacement.
But the leader, what was the size of the crew on the leader?
The leader would be about 100 of us. That includes, it's a Colburn, Colburning ship again. That's stokers, well, everybody, a total of about 100. There were 6 of us. All I can remember is 2 of them, us. Another one of the flotilla was a HMS Skipjack. Well, she blew up at Oban. Well, she didn't blow up. She got blown up at Oban by a mine, and the mine didn't hit her. She blew herself up, if you can believe that. Because when you're... This is... I don't know if that's still on, but anyway, when you're in a mine, you bring a mine to the surface, you've got to get it down below. Well, there's only one way to get it down below. It's fire at it. And it used to be firing practice with rifles. You puncture it. If you hit one of the horns, it'll blow up. But when you puncture it, it becomes waterlogged and it sinks. Well, when a thing... You drop a penny into the water, it don't go straight down, it goes like that. As the tide takes it down, the same applies to a mine. It gradually goes down slowly. And when it reaches the bottom, it don't stop there like that. The tide takes
washes it to and fro.
Wash it about like that. Because two and two making four, this one that sunk, rolled over like that, and the skipjack happened to be over the top of it, and it blew up. It under the horns and blew up, and she just went out the water and broke it too. And I think there's about four saved out the 120. Yep, that was at Oban. They put a minefield out at Oban. And us, that's when I left as leader then, because our A bracket, propeller bracket, holding the propeller shaft, they call it the A bracket. It got distorted.
By the blast?
Yeah. And now, because we were immobile, we were taken to Glasgow and we were there for repairs. We were given a week's leave and the repairs were going to take about a month or so and that. Well, we were just idle there, so we all went back to barracks. We were decommissioned again.
What sort of duties was the leader doing when you joined her?
Minesweeping. Always minesweeping. You went out... The routine never varied. You went out in the morning at 6 o'clock and you come in about 6 o'clock and you swept in pairs. There were six of them. You swept the channels, keeping the channels clear out of scupper flow for the fleet to get out. And you had 9 days of that. The 10th day you came in for a day's rest. The day's rest meant coaling ship. So you coaled ship. I didn't. I was a wireless operator. I didn't. I was...
Did you have to handle a lot of wireless traffic while you were doing this duty? Was there a lot of traffic for you to handle while you were doing...
Wireless traffic?
Yes.
No traffic. You just listened in. Direct, you start pressing that key, you give your position away. On direction find, mind you, it was very crude correction to direction finding in those days, but they could pinpoint you, and they knew there was something happening.
So, if your ship wanted to make a signal to the other minesweeper, how would it do that? Would it use a lamp?
Well, it would do it by semaphore, wouldn't it?
Or semaphore.
It's because you're within visual contact of each other. But then, in those, now they do it with a what they call paravanes that go out in the bows, but then it was a sweep between two ships.
So it was a wire between the two.
That's
What would the distance between the two ships be for sweeping?
A couple hundred yards. Sweep, and then you go do that, then round, back again, so that you keep the channel clear.
And how far away from the base at Scarpa would the channel extend?
Well, that is if I couldn't say for sure, but all I know, we kept going up so far in the Pentland Firth, the Skerries, as we called it. You had your position to do each day. Each day you had 9 days of it, different positions, so that you kept the channel reasonably clear, so that the fleet could get out.
Did you find that people got very bored with doing that day in, day out?
Oh, you got bored, all right. Nothing to do, Ron, do you? Well, you buy your ship's duties. You had two of us, you had two operators, you had watch on and watch off. 4 hours on, 4 hours off. Well, you're 4 hours off, you've got to sleep, eat and sleep, and then back on watch again.
And on watch you'd just be listening on headphones, would
yeah.
you?
Yep. Yep. You put everything down, you read, pick up. But you don't transmit, except an extreme emergency. Because you press that key, you're giving your position away.
Did you have any incidents or emergencies?
No, only rough weather.
Was the leader a happy ship?
Yeah. I only had one unhappy ship, and that was the last one I was on. 1928, when they sent me home. My time was up, and they sent me on by merchant ship. They wanted me to stop. There was four of us. They wanted us to stop, and a Lieutenant Commander Wilson, who was in charge of communications on this ship, HMS Vindictive, he said, if you'll stop on the ship, he said, I'll see you don't lose anything by it by stopping to the end of the commission. He said, why do you want to go home? I said, I'll tell you the truth, sir. I said, I'm fed up right to here.